This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with musician and musical historian Eli Smith on music and radical politics.
Eli presented some of this at the Left Forum, but it's about music, revolution, and crisis.
We'll talk about a new book, The Terrorization of Dissent and the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act.
Specifically, and discussed on the show, is the book's documenting of corporations and the U.S. government complicity to prosecute animal rights activists.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
The role of music has been a defining element in telling our stories in the labor movement, political battles against the war in Vietnam, the civil rights movement. When we hit the streets, there is music behind us. Musical historian and folk musician Eli Smith gave a presentation at the Left Forum this year on the satirical songs of the IWW, including the work of Joe Hill, the early works of Pete Seeger, Woody Guthrie, and John Hancock's of the Southern Tenant Farmers Union. It was the first racially integrated union in the South that used indigenous folk music to fight for the rights of sharecroppers. Eli Smith joins us today to talk about his work on music and left politics. Well, this is a very special program for us. Eli Smith, glad to have you here. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much.
It's great to have you here, Eli. I know you're Michael Smith's son, one of our hosts, but that's not why you're here. You're here because this presentation you're about to give us, I understand, is fantastic.
Well, it's about music and politics. Eli, one question for you, and then we can start in. The way I look at it, there were radicalizations in this country that preceded the one that affected me in the 60s, affected Michael, affected Heidi that came in on the edge of it. There was one in the 30s, of course, and then there was one before the First World War. And I think it's safe to say that we're going through the beginning of another one now. So the music you're about to play for us informs what went on back then and what's going on now. Talk to us about that.
Well, thank you, and it's nice to be on your program to give your listeners something a little bit different than what's usually on Law and Disorder, so I hope they will enjoy it. I'd like to introduce your listeners to a few of the musicians, a few of the personalities that really made music in the previous radicalizations in America that was used on picket lines and in social struggles. I think there's a tendency in America now to, first of all, be amnesiac and not remember anything that happened more than, you know, 5 minutes ago or 5 years ago or something. So this is a great way to not only learn about the radical tradition in America, but to actually feel it, because that's the power of music, is the power to feel and to feel what happened in the past in history. And also to remember that music and culture doesn't have to be totally trashy like we always hear on the radio and see on television, just like, you know, the worst. But in fact, music can have a social function, actually, in all different aspects of society, including in social struggles. So I'd like to give a brief presentation, I guess, on a few aspects of the historical American labor movement and the music and some musicians that animated it with recorded examples. Let's go for it. Why don't we hear the first track here, at least a little bit of it. I think a lot of people will be familiar with it. And this is just an example of the work of a man named Harry McClintock, who was a singer with the IWW, the International Workers of the World. I'd like to play just a bit of his most famous song called The Big Rock Candy Mountain. So maybe we can hear a moment of that.
Sun went down and the jungle fire was burning. Down the track came a hobo hiking, and he said, "Boys, I'm not turning. I'm headed for a land that's far away, beside the crystal fountains. So come with me, we'll go and see the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, there's a land that's fair and bright, where the handouts grow on bushes, and you sleep out every night. where the boxcars all are empty and the sun shines every day. On the birds and the bees and the cigarette trees, the lemonade springs where the bluebird sings in the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, all the cops have wooden legs, and the bulldogs all have rubber teeth, and the hens lay soft-boiled eggs. The farmer's trees are full of fruit, and the barns are full of hay. Oh, I'm bound to go where there ain't no snow, where the rain don't fall, the wind don't blow, in the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, you never change your socks, and the little streams of alcohol come a-trickling down the rocks. The brakemen have to tip their hats, and the railroad bulls are blind. There's a lake of stew and a whiskey too. You can paddle all around them in a big canoe in the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, the jails are made of tin, and you can walk right out again as soon as you are in. There ain't no short-handled shovels, no axes, saws, or picks. I'm a-goin' to stay where you sleep all day, where they hung the Turk that invented work in the Big Rock Candy Mountains. I'll see you all this coming fall in the Big Rock Candy Mountains.
Well, that was Harry McClintock, who was a famous singer with the International Workers of the World in the early 20th century. He was actually Joe Hill's roommate in a little house in California. Of course, Joe Hill was probably the best-known IWW songwriter, but he was framed on a murder charge and was executed before he had the chance to record. So actually hearing Harry McClintock is a great way to understand what that music was like, and we're going to hear more of his political songs in a second. Let me tell you a little bit more about Harry McClintock, a very interesting character. He was born in Knoxville, Tennessee in 1882, son of a railroad worker. But he began drifting around when he was a boy, and he ran away from home to join a circus. He also worked on the railroad and hoboed in Africa, in South Africa. He worked as a seaman. He saw action in the Philippines as a civilian mule train packer supplying American troops. And in 1899, he actually was in China as an aide to a newsman covering the Boxer Rebellion. And then, this is a fascinating guy, and then he comes back to the United States and becomes involved in the IWW, the International Workers of the World. The song you just heard, Big Rock Candy Mountain, reached number one on Billboard's, quote, hillbilly charts in 1939, and was actually a hit again in 2000 on the Oh Brother, Where Art Thou movie soundtrack. But in the early 20th century, Harry McClintock was, quote, inhabiting a shack with Joe Hill in California and singing on IWW picket lines. Harry died in 1957, and scratch that. Now I'd like to play one of Harry McClintock's, Now I'd like to play one of Joe Hill's songs that Harry McClintock recorded for a folklorist in the 1950s, shortly before his death, and he tells a great story. So maybe we can hear that now. This is a song called The Preacher and the Slave, which makes fun of organized religion used as a tool to suppress people's righteous indignation at their foul treatment by the capitalist system. So let's put that on, The Preacher and the Slave.
Yeah.
Did you know Joe Hill?
Yeah, I know him well as anybody could be said to know him. He was a man of mystery. Nobody really knew the guy.
Well, where did you first meet Joe Hill?
Well, I think it was in Portland, Oregon.
When was this?
That was in the fall of 1910. And incidentally, I had the honor of singing The Preacher and the Slave. You know, the long-haired preacher song? Everybody knows that.
Yeah.
I had the honor of singing that for the first time in public. Joe brought it in and turned it over to the secretary of the Portland local of the IWW, and he got out a leaflet on it, and I think we sold at the Second Street meeting. The First Street meeting, we weren't prepared. We didn't have it printed, but the Second Street meeting, we sold over $30 worth of them at a dime a throw or whatever they wanted to contribute.
So So you were the first one to sing it?
I was the first one to sing it in public.
Sing it now.
Long-haired preacher?
Yeah.
Long-haired preachers come out every night, try to tell you what's wrong and what's right. But when asked how about something to eat, they will answer with voices so sweet, you will eat by and by in that glorious land above the sky, way up high, work and pray, live on hay. You'll get pie in the sky when you die. Holy rollers and jumpers come out, and they sing and they clap and they shout. Give your money to Jesus, they say. He will cure all diseases today. And you will eat by and by in that glorious land above the sky. Work and pray, live on hay. You'll get pie in the sky when you die. And the Starvation Army, they play, and they sing, and they clap, and they pray, till they get all your coin on the drum. But they'll tell you when you're on the bum, you will eat by and by in that glorious land above the sky, way up high, work and pray, live on hay. You'll get pie in the sky when you die. Working men of all countries unite, side by side we for freedom will fight. When this world and its wealth we have gained, to the grafters we'll sing this refrain. You will eat by and by when you've learned how to cook and to fry and bake a pie. Chop some wood, it'll do you good, and you'll eat in the sweet by and by, you wise guy.
Well, Harry McClintock was a very successful radio performer and country music performer in the 1920s and 30s, a little bit later in his career. And was popular in a national way through the radio and so on. He had a hit with "Goodbye Old Paint," a classic American cowboy song, and he was a real Westerner and a real kind of old-timey American character, and yet a radical through and through. And I think that's worth remembering as America keeps changing and apparently getting worse. Maybe we could hear a little bit of his classic recording of the cowboy song, "Goodbye Old Paint." I love this song. I think it's worth playing.
Old Paint,
your hay. My wagon is loaded and rolling away. My wagon is loaded and rolling away. I'm up in the saddle, the reins are in my hand. Goodbye, fair lady, I'm a leaving Cheyenne. Goodbye, fair lady, I'm a leaving Cheyenne.
Anyway,
oh, Eli, you're writing a new song called New Paint, is that true?
Yes, New Paint. It's actually about vinyl siding that you can put on your home. If anyone's interested in vinyl siding, they should call me at 1-800, you know. In any case, Harry McClintock, an authentic American cowboy singer with a fascinating history. Joe Hill's roommate, an authentic voice of the IWW, the International Workers of the World. And to me, the most vibrant and amazing movement in American labor history. I'd like to close on Harry McClintock by hearing a song of his called 50 Years From Now. This was written in 1931, which makes him, I guess, be speaking about 1981, but could just as easily be now. It's a great song of social commentary. It actually is almost like a Phil Oakes song. It's like a proto-Phil Oakes song a little bit. To me, this is what Joe Hill would have done if he could have. If he'd lived.
Now over there in Europe, they're having lots of fun. Their taxes and their big war debts have got them on the run. We have to lend them money to keep them on their feet, while a million good Americans are sleeping in the street. Our international bankers are busy night and day. They're figuring all the ways and means to give our dough away. Our working men are unemployed, they're raising quite a row. Prosperity's around the corner 50 years from now. 50 years from now, 50 years from now. Just tell the grocery man you'll pay him 50 years from now. When the landlord and the gas man come with both hands full of bills, just point toward the west and say there's gold in them there hills. And 50 years from now, 50 years from now, we'll find a way to pay your bill somehow. Oh, the situation's funny. We've lent Europe all our money, and they won't be able to pay us back till 50 years from now. Our domestic situation is certainly hard to beat. We have to go round hungry 'cause we've raised too much to eat. We cannot ride our railroads 'cause we haven't got the fare. And we've piled up stacks of clothing till we've nothing much to wear. They'll throw you in the hoosegow if you steal a loaf of bread. But the gangsters fill our cities full of powder, smoke, and lead. We'd like to find the answer, but it seems we don't know how. We'll probably come out all right in 50 years from now. 50 years from now, 50 years from now. Oh, everything will be lovely in 50 years from now. In the meantime, all you have to do is stand around and grin and do your starving gracefully or the cops will run you in. It's really quite the style to take it with a smile. It's supposed to help a hungry man somehow. Though it's hard on some beginners to do without their dinners, just think of their nice trim waistlines in 50 years from now. Oh, 50 years from now, 50 years from now. We won't remember a thing about it 50 years from now. We'll be out in the marble orchard where the tombstones are in bloom. Underneath the green grass there's always plenty of room. And 50 years from now, 50 years from now, we'll be down where they can't reach us with a plow. And among the saints and sinners and the losers and the winners, it won't matter a heck of a lot 50 years from now.
Well, I'd like to move forward in American history a little bit now. I should mention that this was a presentation that I gave last week at the Left Forum Conference, which was a big conference of left-wing activists, intellectuals, academics here in New York, and that's how I put this whole presentation together, so it's great to take it on the radio here. I'd like to talk now about the Southern Tenant Farmers Union, which was founded in 1934 to organize sharecroppers in the Deep South. It's little remembered today, but a phenomenal movement. The STFU acronym was established as a response to policies of the Agricultural Adjustment Administration in the New Deal. Amazingly, they were a racially integrated union in the Deep South, and they were quite effective. Basically, the rich planters that owned the plantations that the sharecroppers worked on were being paid by the government to not produce crops in order to inflate the price of food. But the rich planters were paid by the government not to plant, but the rich planters kept the money, leaving the sharecroppers in the lurch, utterly. And I'd like to feature one of their songwriters now, an African-American man named John Hancock. He lived to be 88 years old. He was born in 1904 and died in 1992. Hancock was born in Arkansas. His father was a landowner, and Hancock attended school up to the ninth grade and idolized the poet Paul Laurence Dunbar. But the Hancock family lost their homestead after Hancock's father was crushed by a wagon in an accident in 1921, and they were made sharecroppers at that point. In 1935, John Hancock joined the Southern Tenant Farmers Union and, quote, found out singing was more inspiring than talking to get the attention of people. That's still true. He began writing songs and poetry to rally the group's members. And 2 years later, he was recorded by Charles Seeger, Pete Seeger's father, for the Library of Congress. So I'd like to play one of his songs now. This is one that I enjoy very much called Join the Union Tonight.
1933, we plowed up across. Join the union tonight. Oh, them plants had such a sop. Join the union tonight. Come along. All workers, come along. Help the union to grow strong. Oh, get in, roll, stop toting such a load. Join the union tonight. One man can't do none by himself. Join the union tonight. But work hard and starve to death. Join the union tonight. Come along. All workers, come along. Help the union to grow strong. Oh, get in, roll, stop toting such a load. Join the union tonight.
Well, I guess I'd like to point out that John Hancock was an African-American man from the Deep South. He was well-versed in folk culture and tradition. That's where how he grew up. And that song was based on a popular sort of folk song in his region called Gonna Raise a Ruckus Tonight, which is a fun song. Maybe we could hear a little bit of the Georgia Yellowhammers playing Raise a Ruckus Tonight so you can know the kind of source that John Hancock was working with in making his songs of social commentary.
Promised me I'm gonna raise a ruckus tonight. That when she dies, she's gonna set me free. She's gonna raise a ruckus tonight. Oh, come on, children, come along. While the moon is shining bright, get on the boat down the river, boat. I'm gonna raise a ruckus tonight. Working so hard, trying to raise a ruckus tonight. Cause I've got a woman in the white folks' yard, trying to raise a ruckus tonight. Oh, come on, children, come along. While the moon is shining bright, get on the boat down the river, float. I'm trying to raise a ruckus tonight. I hang my bucket on the white folks' seat, gonna raise a ruckus tonight. Oh, come on, children, come along. While the moon is shining bright, get on the boat down the river, float. I'm gonna raise a ruckus tonight.
yard upon a little ribbon tonight. She steals me chickens from the white folks' yard upon a little ribbon tonight. Oh, come on, children, come along, while the moon is shining bright. Get on the boat down the river full upon a little ribbon tonight. I die, go bury me deep on the red river tonight, and put a jug of homebrew at my feet on the red river tonight. Oh, come on, children, come along, while the moon is shining bright. Get on the boat down the river, float around the red river tonight.
It's also fascinating to note, if you could follow the lyrics there, that the lyrics to that song were, my old missus promised me when she died she's going to set me free. And that's obviously coming right out of days of slavery. That's where that song comes from, that John Hancock's made into Join the Union Tonight. John Hancock's wrote some other great songs, including one called We're Going to Roll the Union On. I read an article recently that was even being sung on a picket line within the past couple of months for some striking supermarket workers. So that song remains. And Hancock's actually came out of retirement in the 1980s to write and sing some songs denouncing Ronald Reagan. So maybe we could hear one of his songs called Oh No, We Don't Want Reagan Anymore.
Oh no. Oh no. Oh, no, we don't want Reagan's anymore. He fired the air controllers because they want to raise in their pay. Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, no, we don't want Reagan's anymore. There are millions of working, starving all over the land, and he wants to spend $1 million for the defense. I don't think Reagan got good sense. Oh, no. Oh, no. We don't want Reagan anymore. Oh, no. Oh, no. We sure don't want Reagan anymore. The president of Mexico gave him a white horse. Now he think he's the poor man riding boss. Oh, no. Oh, no. We don't want Reagan anymore. Unless, in election day, let's let the whole world know. We don't want Reagan anymore. Oh, no. Oh, no. Well, we don't want Reagan anymore. Let's dump Reagan in '84. Oh, no. Oh, no. We don't want Reagan anymore.
So that was John Hancock's from the Southern Tenant Farmers Union, an incredible labor movement that sought to organize sharecroppers in the Deep South in the 1930s during the New Deal era.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Champion of labor was known in every land. She fought for right and justice. She she took an old stand.
For our last part of this segment, I'd like to focus on the People's Songs era in the 1930s into the 1940s, which was the kind of the culture surrounding the American Communist Party in New York and elsewhere. Whatever profound political failings they had, they did have a very interesting and vibrant and fun culture. And Pete Seeger, of course, is the best known person to come out of that. But Woody Guthrie, of course, Lead Belly was around, Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, and a woman named Aunt Molly Jackson, who was a fascinating labor organizer and singer from the Kentucky coal fields, who came up to New York to try to raise money for probably the NMU, and discovered in New York an incredible kind of collection of people, including Aaron Copland, the famous classical composer, Charles Seeger, the pioneering ethnomusicologist and folklorist who was Pete Seeger's father, and others. And while she discovered them, they discovered her and realized that American folk music was actually the people's music that they'd been looking for all along and hoping to find as a cultural alternative to what they saw as the corrupt products of the capitalist culture industry. So maybe we could hear Aunt Molly Jackson singing her song, Join the CIO.
What's the CIO?
The CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, part of the Great American Labor Movement.
Right, and they were a more progressive or radical union than the AFL, right?
That's correct. You probably know more about it than me.
The IWW, you could say, was the precursor to the CIO. It was the industrial union as opposed to the AFL, which were the more craft-oriented unions. They eventually merged in the 50s, but the CIO came out of the mass struggles of the 30s.
Including the struggles to organize the coal fields in the Appalachian South. Here's Aunt Molly Jackson, another authentic voice of the American labor movement, with Join the CIO.
I am a union woman, just as brave as I can be. I do not like the bosses, and the bosses don't like me. Join the CIO, come join the CIO. I was raised in Kentucky born and bred. And when I joined the union, they called me Russian Red. Join the CIO, come join the CIO. When my husband asked the boss for a job, this is the words he said. Bill Jackson, I can't work you, sir. Your wife's a Russian Red. Come join the CIO, join the CIO. If you want to join a union as strong as one can be, join the dear old NMU and come along with me. If you want to join a union, step in and come along. We'll all be glad to have you. We're many thousand strong. Come join the CIO, join the CIO. We are many thousand strong, and I am glad to say we're getting stronger and stronger every day. If you want to get your freedom and gain your liberty, join the dear old CIO, also the ILD. Join the CIO, join the CIO. Just join the dear old ILD and come along with me. The workers are all protected for the dear old ILD. Then join the CIO, join the CIO.
Well, here's maybe the most famous song from the American labor movement, and one that I'd like to close this program with. Everybody knows this one, Which Side Are You On? And that was written by another woman from the coal fields of the Appalachian South, a woman named Florence Reese. You can actually see her in the film Harlan County, USA, that Barbara Koppel made in the 1970s. Florence Reese is quite elderly in the movie, but she sings the song, "Which Side Are You On?" There she is. Wow, amazing. Everybody should check that out. And, why don't we hear Florence Reese's version and then follow that up with the version by Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie's band in the 1940s, the Almanac Singers. So here's two versions of "Which Side Are You On?", the original field recording of Florence Reese, once again written in response to the efforts to unionize the coal fields. And follow that up with the Almanac Singers, that's Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie's band in the 40s, "Which Side Are You On?".
Come all you poor workers, good news to you, I'll tell how the good old union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? We're starting our good battle, we know we're sure to win, because we've got the gun thugs a-looking very thin. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? If you go to Harlan County, there is no neutral there. You'll either be a union man or a thug for J.H. Blair. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Come all of you good workers, good news to you I'll tell of how the good old union has come in here to dwell.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
My daddy was a miner and I'm a miner's son, and I'll stick with the union till every battle's won.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
They say in Harlan County there are no neutrals there. You'll either be a union man or a thug for J.H. Blair.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Oh, workers, can you stand it? Oh, tell me how you can. Will you be a lousy scab or will you be a man?
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Don't scab for the bosses, don't listen to their lies. Us poor folks haven't got a chance unless we organize.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Well, Eli, that was an amazing cut, and by her particularly. What's her name again?
Right, so Florence Reese is the author of "Which Side Are You On?", and I think it was written to the tune of an old English ballad called "Jack Arrow" or the "Jack Monroe."
But that's in Harlan County, and she wrote that at the key times in the struggle in Harlan County, right?
Yeah, in the early 30s, probably.
In Kentucky, and as you referenced Barbara Koppel's film about, you know, those labor struggles continuing and continuing.
That's right, and I'd like to say a few words about, you know, protest music today. I think the field where that's most prevalent is probably in hip-hop, conscious rap, and there's some good stuff coming out of that, although it's not exactly stuff that you can sing along with necessarily. But what I think is really interesting into the future is the Mexican and Latin American migrants that are coming to the United States who are doing incredible work with union organizing and stuff like that, but also have a vibrant folk music tradition, which is very strong in Mexico and elsewhere in Latin America, places that still have a vibrant rural culture, which the United States no longer has. We just have suburbs. And I think that's going to be a very interesting and fruitful region for the continuation of American folk music being, or I shouldn't say American, but folk music in the United States from whatever source, whatever national and regional source, being used in the labor movement. And I'm fascinated to see how that unfolds, how Latino workers in the United States continue to use music in the labor struggle, as well as all other American workers. I'm just sticking around to see what happens next. So thank you guys so much for having me on the program.
This was a really moving show, Eli, and I really appreciate it. I've loved a lot of that music since I was a kid, but to hear it put into historical context and as part of the struggle, fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's great to hear the authentic voices of the American labor movement from the past. I hope that gives everyone strength as well as just edifying to hear. So, yeah.
Eli, before you go, you and Peter Siegel did an album of American Union songs, and I wonder how you get a hold of that album.
Right, okay, yeah. I recently recorded an album of American labor songs with my friend Peter. It's an album called The Union Makes Us Strong. So if you look that up on the internet, The Union Makes Us Strong. Eli Smith, that's my name. Peter Siegel is my friend that I recorded with. You could probably find that pretty easily. I'd also like to mention that I host the annual Brooklyn Folk Festival, which is a three-day music festival in the spring, so you've missed that. But also the Washington Square Park Folk Festival, which is coming up in September. And you'll find me and a lot of really interesting American folk music and world folk music at a place called the Jalopy Theater on Columbia Street in Brooklyn. So people should come out to the Jalopy Theater.
Yeah, as one of the hosts here, I've been to all three, and every one of the venues is great. Brooklyn Folk Festival next spring. Washington Square Folk Festival, when is that normally, Eli?
It's just a one-day event, September 14th, free outdoor concert in Washington Square Park. Should be really good.
And Jalopies in Red Hook is a great place to hang out, but it's also an incredible place to hear the wonderful Eli Smith. Thank you, Eli.
Thank you, Eli.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Terrorization of dissent, corporate repression, legal corruption, and the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act is a collection of essays by lawyers, scholars, and activists that include interviews with those who suffered from the AETA's conspiracy provisions. Editors Jason Del Gandio and Anthony Nocella have compiled essential information to document how the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act is a clear violation of the First Amendment. Specifically, the book documents how corporations and the U.S. government conspire under this law to prosecute animal rights activists and acts of civil disobedience involving environmental issues under the specter of terrorism. Right now, according to Nocella and Del Gandio, corporate profit determines what can or can't be done to animals and the environment. Co-editor Anthony Nocella joins us today to talk about this historic examination. He's also a senior fellow at the Dispute Resolution Institute at Hamlin Law School. Anthony, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on your new book, Terrorization of Dissent, Corporate Repression, Legal Corruption, and the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And we'd like to start, even though we've covered the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act over the past several years on Law and Disorder, just with a brief overview of what it is and why you and your other co-editor elected to write a whole book on this or to compile essays on it.
The importance of this act has really shaped, you know, how the government looks at one of the larger movements in the United States, if not the world. And I think that the animal advocacy, animal welfare, animal rights, animal liberation movements have been demonized and stigmatized as terrorists through the media and government through this particular act. And the question is this act constitutional? And, you know, of course, the text and so many animal advocates, as well as civil liberties activists and lawyers, have noted it's unconstitutional. But more so, what are the effects of this law? And was it even necessary to put into law this? And why? What's the difference between the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, which was signed into law in 1992, where this act, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, was signed in 2006, you know, post 9/11, and who, you know, influenced this act to be pushed into law. And it wasn't really government. There was, you know, three significant organizations that really made this law, you know, pushed into effect, and that's the Animal Enterprise Protection Coalition, the AEPC, the Animal Legislative Exchange Council, which a lot of the human rights and political activists know of ALEC because of their work in the development of the private prisons and the prison industrial complex. And then thirdly, the Center for Consumer Freedom, which for many years has posted images as well as bios and pictures of demonizing animal rights activists.
What is at stake for corporations and for these entities that really push this through?
Well, I think that any logical, you know, CEO or corporation is going to say, I don't want anything to threaten my product. And that product, in the case of animals, is anything from circuses to SeaWorlds to clothing, from leather to fur to also eating. We can do away with circuses and fur and a lot of different clothing I think people can live without. But one thing that can't live without is food. And I think the largest, you know, pushing lobbyist groups have been from the ag, see the ag gag bills popping up and not allowing videoing or not allowing taking pictures of even animals going into slaughter. That would be under the interference of the animal enterprise companies. And so we have to look at of the real conflict is between food, you know, and do we want people to have a food, plant-based diet or an animal-based diet? And so there's a lot of people pushing for that because there's hundreds of billions of dollars protecting that kind of, you know, paradigm of people eating meat and fish and chicken. And so if anybody threatens that multi-billion dollar industry, what under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, you are deemed as a terrorist. And I think that is, you know, to wash away all the rhetoric, that is what this law is specifically speaking about. And that's why it was expanded from the Animal Enterprise Protection Act to the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act.
Anthony, just recently, Tyler Lang and Kevin Olive were indicted under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And I wanted to ask you about that because I think it's something that our listeners need to know about and try to help them.
Yeah, these are two wonderful activists that were indicted on federal terrorism charges for releasing a number of mink and fox in the Midwest. And while Tyler is, I believe, not incarceration, Kevin Olive is incarcerated, and he's indicted and incarcerated for 30 months for having bolt cutters in his car and not using bolt cutters to hit somebody over the head, not using bolt cutters to cut wires for whatever reason, or to, he just had bolt cutters. So now what we're looking at is you better be aware of what is in your car, from a screwdriver to a hammer to now a bolt cutter in your car, because what might be in your car and might get you convicted. And I think that is really stretching the law. And I think anybody, hopefully from the Tea Party to the Democrats, the Green Party, would say that, you know, arresting somebody for a bolt cutter is not enough to arrest somebody.
But he was in some fashion connected by law enforcement with these actions. Was there a nexus?
Yes.
Right. But still, a tenuous one with the bolt cutters.
These two men are looking at long prison terms. And I wonder whether there's a defense committee or a website where people can look it up and try to help them.
The Center for Constitutional Rights has issued a press release in support of them. Is there a defense committee yet?
I believe that, you know, you can find a lot of information by Googling them, and then they also have a defense Facebook, which a lot of updates are, and each of them have their own pages as well. Okay. So you can find information about Tyler Lang and Kevin Olive and, you know, join their support, write letters to them, send books while Tyler's not incarcerated, Kevin is, and you can, you know, donate to his cause as well as, you know, speaking on behalf of those two nonviolent activists. And I think that's the, if I go down the street and I spray paint on a wall, that's vandalism. And I might look at a misdemeanor, you know, a serious misdemeanor, and get a fine, you know, and possibly, you know, get arrested, of course, for that. While if I do that same act on behalf of animals and I write animals, I love animals on a McDonald's, then it's a terrorist act. And I think that's under the ATA, that's the very significant difference, is that vandalism or property destruction should be looked at as just that, vandalism and property destruction. And it's not. It's looked at as the same, in the same realm as the horrible tragedy on September 11th or the bombing in London or in Oklahoma. And this is not, you know, what is going on with these activists. There's, you know, many of the times they're spray painting or just holding signs. It's anything that jeopardizes the profiting or the expansion or threatens or puts fear into individuals that are involved in the animal enterprise or any corporation or company. That's what the animal enterprise is.
Anthony Nocella, you co-edited a book called Terrorization of Dissent, Corporate Repression, Legal Corruption, and the Animal Enterprise Terrorism. And I wanted to ask you, what was the genesis of this book? What was your idea about getting it out there? How's it doing?
Well, it just came out a few weeks ago, and, you know, I really thank you for having me on to speak about it, and your co-host is in the book, which is wonderful, Heidi. And the point is that law schools, political science departments, think tanks need a text that comes from a variety of viewpoints, specifically looking at the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, because I think it's one of the most unconstitutional laws since, you know, COINTELPRO of the 1950s, which, you know, moved into the 1970s. But we have to understand how unconstitutional this is on activists. And if activists, and I'm very involved in prison issues and youth justice and environmental, et cetera, and I think that activists need to understand that it's a universal issue, or we will go into the, well, it didn't affect me, I wasn't a socialist. Well, if I wasn't a communist, they didn't, you know, they came for me, but I wasn't a communist, so I didn't do anything. And I think we can go with that rhetoric, but what we're going to find out is that these laws are going to be expanded more and more and more, targeting activists, you know, protesting this week and last week for the Palestinians. And so this text is by, you know, activists as well as professors and scholars as well as lawyers coming together to look at corporate repression, which is different than political repression. And I think we have to really understand the difference between how corporations are influencing laws and writing, literally writing the laws and the bills into effect, while political repression is really law enforcement as well as senators and politicians influencing laws. And I don't think that's the case today. We really have corporations making laws instead of politicians.
Anthony, we only have a few minutes left, but I was curious, during the process of editing and putting this compilation together, did your thoughts change in any fashion, or did you become aware of aspects that you previously hadn't really thought about?
You know, I thought it was going to be a text that, and I really, you know, honestly thought this book was going to be outdated, and that the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, because of my own, quote, common sense, that this the act was going to be overthrown. So I was kind of nervous with Jason Delgandio, the co-editor, if the book was going to even be, you know, useful. So we were really wanting to look at the terrorization as well, and how this it's not just this act, because tomorrow it might even be worse, this act, or it might be overthrown, which is our hopes, that we might not want to focus on just this act, but also corporate repression and how corporate repression influences from oil corporations to petroleum to a variety of other, you know, industries, and how they use the government as a puppet. And I think that's why we expanded the title and how this project kind of moved from the ATA to a larger issue that is going on with all activists, and that's why we kind of focused on the terrorization of dissent. And we're not criminalizing activists, which we did in, you know, in the 60s and the 70s. What we're doing is now just labeling them as terrorists. So that's kind of, I would say, how this book, you know, developed from the beginning to the end.
And what's next in store? Are you working on any other writing or editing projects?
A few other projects, but I would say that the big thing from this book is the National Weekend of Action Against the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, which is September 5th, 6th, and 7th. And a lot of activists, as well as people in the book, and a lot of different organizations, we have about 20 different organizations already signing on to this, to have forums, film series, protest rallies, and teach-ins and workshops on the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And what I'm finding out, we just put up the weekend of action because we don't want to do the day of action because, of course, strategically, not everybody can most likely do that particular day we pick. And so we do it prior to this September 11th, which is a very pivotal day, and which no need to note it. So you can find it on Facebook as well as the Institute for Critical Animal Studies, which I'm the executive director of. And so you can find it at the Institute for Critical Animal Studies, and there'll be information there and what cities are involved and who to contact and the days and the times and the locations and stuff.
Great. Anthony Nocella, co-editor of the book, Terrorization of Dissent, Corporate Repression, Legal Corruption, and the Animal Enterprise Terrorism. Very good to have you on the show, Anthony. Good luck with the book and keep up the good work.
Thank you so much to both of you.
Take care, Anthony.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.